It's time for Branding Business, the only show that brings branding experts and corporate executives together to explore how branding your business can improve both your top-line growth and bottom-line performance. Brought to you by Rekus Baird. And now, here's your host.
Ray Baird, co-founder of Rekus Baird. And today, we're going to have a nice discussion around a topic that a lot of marketers out there have asked about, and it's going to be about how to successfully brand or rebrand your company. We have a special guest, Grant Johnson, and I've known Grant for probably over 20 years, and he's, you know, a high-tech marketing expert that has a lot of deep domain experience in building brands. Some of those brands that you're going to be familiar with is AST Computer. He's also worked, you know, with FileNet, which IBM went and purchased after they built that brand. Also helped create the brand FrontBridge, and Microsoft bought that company. So there's the companies that he's worked for and who's buying them. And now recently he's at Pegasystems. So I specifically wanted Grant to join on this conversation with his experience in branding and rebranding. So welcome, Grant, to Branding Business.
Hey, Ray, it's great to be here.
Well, you know, let's just dive right into it. Obviously, throughout the years, you've successfully branded many companies that have actually been purchased by even larger brands. And for our listeners out there, maybe you just start a little bit by telling them, you know, what's your secret and process and what you've learned through this rebrand and branding experience?
Sure, Ray. Well, as you said, I've done this for nearly two decades, and I've got a few scars along the way, learned a few lessons as well. But the first key principles tightly defined the drivers and the key objectives for branding or rebranding. So are we looking to a brand refresh or brand transformation? When I arrived with this company called Big Fish, kind of an interesting name around the dot-com days of 2002, it was determined that I needed to drive a transformation. So we needed a new company logo, a new name, new positioning, messaging, brand identity. And I came up with the name FrontBridge because we were trying to sell enterprises, and Big Fish sort of smacked of dot-com and kind of scared some of our enterprise buyers. At FileNet, the brand had been established, but it was really about refreshing the brand and building on earlier progress to help drive brand differentiation, because as FileNet grew, it started competing against the big boys like IBM and EMC and Oracle. And ultimately, as you said, Ray, IBM got tired of losing to FileNet and bought the company. So at Pega, I've been there about 2.5 years, and it's really encompassing creating an entire brand system and architecture. Pega had grown to a little over 200 million. When I got there, we were over 400 million on the way to 500 this year. But there was really no systematic approach to brand identity or brand architecture or even anybody who understood the word brand management. Pega had a working logo. It's a symbol for Pegasus, the flying horse. So I left that alone. But everything else, from the color palette to the graphic style to naming conventions, the brand personality, it either needed to be created or changed. And I came up with a simple way to help our 2,000 employees relate to the brand personality. We had determined that the personality could map to our name Pega. So Pega, passionate, engaging, genuine, and adaptive. And then I created this employee video called How Pega Are You? And I had various employees around the world say, I'm passionate, I'm engaging. And they sort of talked about how they'd embody our four key brand personality traits, which helps them become brand ambassadors. And so this approach, together with our online brand education, really helped get everybody in the company on board with the new brand. And if you think about it, of doing this for a while, if you can get brand advocacy to be synonymous with your company advocacy, you can really harness the power of your people, especially in the days of social media, to help you build brand momentum.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. So if I hear you correctly, and having worked on, a few of these brands with you, you know, momentum is absolutely key. But establishing kind of, you know, early on what is the desire of change is absolutely critical so that you can align, you know, expectation. Because it seemed like from one end, it was a little bit of, you know, rebranding, and another end, it was completely creating a completely new brand. And so each one has kind of different set of circumstances with it. I think, you know, a question that I'd like to ask that will help our kind of listeners, because it's one that's asked quite a bit when we're in the branding stages, you know, what is the biggest challenge that companies face with rebranding, or what are things that they need to think about, you know, before they engage in such a process?
Well, that's a good one, Ray. I mean, once you've got the first question involved of what the, you know, the mission is, what's the purpose for rebranding, you need to get an agreement on how to approach it. There's as many ways to brand and rebrand as there are companies who, you know, profess to be experts in it, and, you know, individuals have some level of knowledge, but you have to define the scope, you know, over what time, over what cost, are we going to, you know, change the logo, are we going to put new signs on the building? It can be very complex, especially in dealing with companies of scale. And then who's going to make the decisions besides, you know, the CMO or head of marketing? One thing that I found works pretty well is having a simple phased approach. I recently used one called a three-phase process, and it's something that, you know, my executive peers and all the stakeholders, including the board, can easily understand and support. Well, so, for example, at Pega, I define phase one as brand assessment. You know, let's really figure out where we are, what we've done, sort of the state of the brand and, you know, competitors and so forth. And then phase two is brand development. Let's really put together the brand promise, the personality, color palette, all the dimensions that will help differentiate the brand to all the stakeholders and customers and influencers in the market. And then, you know, phase three is about execution. That's where the rubber meets the road. What are you going to do to bring the brand to life? What sort of marketing and communications and, you know, company deliverables will be undertaken and executed? And under each phase, I define what we would do, who would be involved, customers, partners, even the board at Pega, for example, and how we'd report on our findings so we could make progress and agree on these important decisions, such as our brand promise and a brand identity. You know, that's a good way to put together a roadmap. It gives people direction. But another major challenge that I always face is developing the consensus on what it is you're actually going to change. It can be somewhat controversial because once you do the brand assessment, obvious inconsistencies and variance in brand quality and standards will emerge. And you're going to have to tell people, we're going to throw out what you created. And it's like saying, I'm sorry, but your baby is ugly. You know, it's never easy to deliver this change message because, after all, a lot of these decisions are subjective. At AST, for example, in the 90s, I did a brand audit, and I found seven different taglines in English alone. Our official color was one of these Pantone blues, but in every different country, it was executed in somewhat different shades. So we really just didn't have brand consistency. You know, fundamentally, the biggest challenge is getting agreement on what to change. And you come up with the hypothetical, you'll find out various options about, hey, this brand identity, this color, that color, these personality dimensions, or this differentiated promise. But the hard part is really getting agreement among all the desirable alternatives. What do you choose? So at Pega, we came up with three alternatives for our brand promise. And they're really on a continuum of how aggressive we wanted to be. We worked with Rikus Baird, as Ray knows, on this. And, you know, the first one was, we help you drive continuous business improvement. The second was, we help you become more customer-centric. And the third was, we transform the way your business works. So we did this great research, talked to a bunch of customers and stakeholders, and we found that both the influencers and my whole team favored this transformative expression because it was the most aspirational. But when we talked among the various stakeholders, including the board, they felt that this brand promise might overreach our ability to deliver. There's nothing more important to deliver on your promises. So we landed on helping organizations become more customer-centric. We've been working on it now for a year and a half. It's working well for us, and especially because we keep enhancing what we actually deliver to reinforce the brand promise.
That's a great overall piece of advice for marketers and brands out there that are trying to figure out, you know, what is their point of differentiation. A lot of them don't know that you can actually, you know, test positioning. And in that particular case is that, you know, when those when the brand test came back, we really put a criteria of, you know, what is most relevant, what's most believable, and what can be defendable. So for marketers out there, you know, testing the overall positioning and using it as a stretch will give them a really good kind of input. I'd like to switch gears a little bit.
Yeah, just one more thing to add to that. I mean, I completely agree. We found great verbatims that supported it. But, you know, one other sort of caveat, especially of all of you out there who work with strong-willed CEOs, you know, sometimes a committee decides, sometimes one person decides, you know, sometimes one person has the loudest vote. You know, getting our CEO, who I report to, behind where we wanted to go really helped move some people off center. They were just sort of, you know, waffling about which way to go because you have to make a choice. So you have to understand, you know, who's going to be most important to helping you get to a conclusion.
Yeah, and absolutely. And in that particular case, it's really using the customer voice to help take opinions out and make it more in terms of factual about what customers believe and how far they can stretch. So I think that's, you know, just wonderful advice for any brands is, especially when they get to the positioning standpoint, is use great technology. In that particular case, you know, it was online type of surveys that gave us wonderful information. Let me switch gears a little bit here. A lot of times after the brand is cast in stone, and like you said, you go through the approach, you go through the development, and now you get into the execution. Explain how do you manage the areas that, you know, you don't control on the brand, those particular touch points, and share a little bit of that philosophy, because a lot has changed in the B2B world in the last 10 years.
It's a customer-driven world. They control the brand, and recently I dialogued with many of my CMO peers at some roundtables in a couple cities around the country on this very same topic. And, you know, at most companies, whether you're B2B or B2C, the CMO, the head of marketing, you know, we don't control the touch points. You know, you might control the web, you know, certainly outbound messaging, but there's a storefront if you've got retail presence. There could be a call center. You have service delivery. You could have partners, you know, channels. Lots of other touch points that you don't control, and what can happen is it leads to a very inconsistent brand experience at best or brand dilution at worst. So what I found works is for marketing really to see themselves the chief brand architects, to define what the brand and customer experience should be at each point. And, you know, that's not enough. I mean, you start with defining it, but you've got to also get the feedback. As you say, Ray, the customer is really going to determine whether your brand's standing out and connecting and creating word of mouth and positive impressions or not. So you've got to get the reports, the measures, and whether you use, you know, Net Promoter Score, the, you know, famous NPS system, or just some other voice of the customer, or just recorded calls, you've got to get some systematic or ad hoc feedback on those touch points you don't control so you can make the appropriate refinements or, in some cases, major changes if things aren't working. In today's customer era, the customers sort of shape your brand in ways that only social media can do, so you have to do a better job monitoring all the touch points. We actually have a technology at Pegasystems that will monitor all the social media talk and, you know, help you to sort the wheat from the chaff and determine whether you really got a crisis brewing or it's just people chatting about. And you find ways that you can continually monitor and, you know, reinforce what's working and then abandon what's not.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You know, we do a lot of discussions with our clients. What has changed? There's a good saying, you know, once what was delivered is now found, where we used to push out marketing and make brochures and, you know, the belly-to-belly selling. Well, now when people look at overall brands, they go online.
You know, I completely agree, Ray. The era of push marketing is dead. It's all about engagement. Really, as marketers, you really have to change. You had David Ocker on the last session in brand relevance, and if you're relevant and you engage with customers, that has a lot to do with your ultimate success.
You've spent a lot of time with technology companies, and so do we from a brand standpoint. One of the things that happens from an evolution standpoint is that these brands all of a sudden become a plethora of different product names or brands. And with the remaining time, I thought it'd be good for you to kind of explain methodology and philosophy as it relates to architecture, you know, master brand, house of brands, and how most companies can really look at it, because we see a lot of waste in energies in managing a whole portfolio of brands that may not even be brands. So maybe talk with the listeners a little bit about your experience, architecture and technology branding within products and names.
Right, yeah, that's a great one, Ray. The tech field that I've been in primarily, there are a lot of engineers who can really relate to this architecture metaphor, so I find it helps when I'm working to try to build a process that gets us to a better outcome. But having a coherent brand architecture provides a structure and consistency to the overall branding process. You have to start with what's going to be the overall overarching brand strategy. You can use a master brand strategy like Lexus and, you know, designate different, you know, product lines with just numbers. Or you're going to have a house of brands. The P&G is pretty famous for that. Or you could have an endorsed approach. You know, Microsoft has pioneered that as well. You see both the brand name, like Xbox, as well as Microsoft or Windows. So the next thing you want to look at is the brand architecture. Having some level of hierarchy when you've got multiple products that define the relationship between the company brand and all the product brands or sub-brands, if you will. And one key structural consideration I've learned is not to create too many levels in brand architecture. You know, most people have difficulty keeping more than two levels in their heads, so it's best to manage to what I would call a streamlined brand architecture. Today, the average consumer probably processes 100,000 pieces of information on a monthly basis, and they're just more inundated with this information, which necessarily reduces their attention level to any individual piece of information. It becomes brief. So you've got to make it easier for your customers and your prospects to understand, identify your brand and brand naming. If you've got too many levels, it kind of gets in the way. The second issue you brought up, Ray, is product naming. If you're a P&G and you can afford to spend $100 million to launch a new product or brand, go ahead. Create a proprietary name that is trademarkable, unique to you. But if you're like most companies that I've worked with, such a level of investment is inconceivable. So I recommend going with either a descriptive product names or perhaps suggestive ones. This supports brand or product extension goals as well because customers can more easily relate existing frame of reference than a new one that each proprietary name might require. So an overriding principle would be simplicity and customer understanding as a driving force in all your naming decisions.
Yeah, beautiful. Beautiful. That's, I think, a great point of advice. We see, in so many cases, a ton of energy and dollars being sent by companies that don't really have a clear overall strategy, like you said, and then make it simple. It always comes back down to simplicity for people to understand the brands. So if you had one critical piece of advice for companies that are going through this rebranding or branding process, Graham, what would that be?
I would say you've got to have a really thick skin. So, that part goes without saying because everybody's going to have an opinion, but more pragmatically speaking, I would hire an outside branding firm to help you with the process. I've done this 5 times, as you know, Ray, in the last approximately 20 years. And while I personally have the expertise to figure it all out with my team, having a senior-level, independent, objective branding partner to kind of help you shape, define, propose, and close on the brand changes, it really helps enormously. The way I see it, if I've got somebody like you or Alan Brew on your team, they say to one of my peers, "Look, the research says this, we feel this way, this is what we've seen work. This will really help you stand out from the competition. What you're aiming for is going to be seen as largely undifferentiated, and here's why." I could say the same thing, but what happens is if I say that to, even one of my peers in the C-level, that person can become defensive. They're going to perhaps kind of nod their head, but then suddenly they become less supportive during this critical change process. I guess to riff on one of my favorite former taglines from American Express, the world's number one service brand, don't go on this journey alone.
Well, thanks, Grant. Really great advice on many different levels. We'd like to thank you for sharing your insights and your experience, real-life applications and kind of experience. And we'd like to thank the listeners for tuning in to Branding Business. Visit the blog, visit often, and best of luck in building your brands.
You've been listening to Branding Business, the only show that brings branding experts and corporate executives together to explore how branding your business can improve both your top-line growth and bottom-line performance. To hear more, simply visit our website, brandingbusiness.com, or tune in next week to learn how you, too, can build your brand and move your business forward. Brought to you by Rikus Baird.